It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your host, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and let's talk legal.
And joining us from Harvell & Collins is Wes Collins. Good morning, Wes.
Hey, Ben, how are you?
We're doing all right. So what do you got going on today? What are we talking about?
Well, you know, we started our first program of the year at the beginning of January talking about, you know, the importance of timing, mm-hmm. really in litigation and really everything that we do. So we're going to wrap that up today. We've worked our way through the discussion with regard to statute limitations. Mm-hmm. Here before the program, you actually brought up an interesting issue with regard to kind of the reverse of the statute limitations. We'll get into that in a minute. But basically what that mm-hmm. pertains to is that normally when you think of statute limitations, it's how long you have to file your lawsuit.
Right.
Like a personal injury, normally it'd be 3 years from the date of the accident. Breach mm-hmm. of contract, normally 3 years from the date of the breach, unless it's under seal, then 10 years. So those kind of things. But kind of the reverse of that would be, let's say that you paid something to a municipality. Let's say that there was something paid relative to some type of tax or something like that that
right.
may end up being found to be unsupported by law. And then
yeah.
there is a requirement for reimbursement. So normally statutes of limitations apply to those type of reimbursements.
Mm-hmm.
Deal with that on a fairly frequent basis. We'll talk about that today as well. But, you know, I think where we were last week was we were just kind of walking our way through the lawsuit stage.
Mm-hmm.
And just to recap with regard to that, you know, it's so vitally important for folks out there listening that in the event that, you know, they do find themselves in a lawsuit, they have to adhere very closely, you know, to these time requirements.
Right.
Most
right.
of them being under the rules of civil procedure. And, you know, in most situations, if you do find yourself in the world of a lawsuit, unless it's a small claims action, then you probably, you know, the best advice is to have an attorney.
Oh,
and then
yeah.
your lawyer's going to be on top of that with regard to the timing.
And now some small claims are, you know, pretty large.
Yeah. Right? The thing about small claims is that, you know, for years and years, it was a $2,000 limit, then three, then four, then five. Now it's jumped to 10.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got some bigger cases that end up at small claims. But one thing that hasn't changed with regard to this small claims or magistrate court, procedure in North Carolina is that, in the event it doesn't go your way, you have a right to appeal.
Right.
So, and that appeal is a immediate start over.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not as though the court reviews what was done before the small claims court judge. You just start over. It's called de novo. Well, magically, it's 10 days. There
mm-hmm.
you go. More timing. You have to, file that notice of appeal and pay the court cost for the appeal within 10 days. In the event you don't do that, you waive it forever. So that would be yet another time requirement that we see. But, you know, in dealing with your typical litigation in district court or small claims court or, superior court, you know, you're going to be dealing with the issue of once you're served, you have 30 days to respond. You
right.
can get an extension. In the event you don't, we talked about this a little bit last week, that you can be defaulted. And what that basically means is that you didn't respond in a timely manner.
Right.
And the court enters a default, which basically means that you've admitted everything this plaintiff is saying about you or
mm-hmm.
about the claim. And in many cases, that then just guts your case. Now, it's not that difficult if there's an entry of default to get that set aside. But normally what happens is that if there's an entry of default, then the plaintiff's attorney then follows up with a default judgment
mm-hmm.
where you then apply to the court. You have a hearing in most cases, and the judge hears it and makes a determination as to whether judgment would be entered by default. And then once that happens, it's like, you know, closing the iron door. I mean, we're kind of
right.
done at that point in
right.
time. Very hard to set it aside. So you can't sit back and hope everything's going to be okay. Because if you let it go that far and there's a default judgment, then the next stage may be the sheriff knocking on your door trying to take your car from you
well,
to
you
collect
know,
on the judgment.
I think a lot of people think, oh, they'll never collect it anyway. You know, that's sort of a street knowledge or street
right.
rumor is that judgments can't be collected. They're so hard to be collected. In some cases they are, but I mean, it's still, you shouldn't ignore that.
Well, you know, what I would say about that is that if you own real property, your judgment, the judgment's going to attach to the real property. And then you can, if you hold a judgment, then you can force the sale of real property in most cases. Also, in the event you wanted to refinance or sell your property, then that judgment's going to be paid. If you have, you know, an aggressive attorney, someone who deals with collection of judgments, which, you know, we do, then you have to go through this writ of execution, basically procedure. And, of course, the person, the debtor, does have the right to disclaim or exclude certain assets, very limited assets. But over and above that, you know, if you're aggressive and, you know, you have a good relationship with basically the deputy sheriff so that they are very aggressive in their collections,
right.
then in many cases, you know, you can collect that judgment.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's something that we look at on a case-by-case basis as well. You know, as we move through the litigation as well, you know, you're talking about also discovery. You're talking about the fact that, as we talked about on the program before, once the lawsuit is filed, then there's going to be written discovery that's sent out. You have 30 days to respond to that. In the event you don't, then in many cases, opposing counsel will file a motion to compel. And if you don't respond, then you could be subject to sanctions under Rule 37, which is, in most cases, paying the other side's attorney's fees.
Right.
That's important.
Mm-hmm.
I've had many cases before where I've taken advantage of that because opposing counsel just has not done what they're supposed to do. And the court, you know, has granted those sanctions for attorney's fees. And that, in many cases, is a kind of a springboard for getting the whole case settled.
Right.
You know,
right.
So if you're able to do that.
So there's lots of different arrows in the quiver there.
That's right. Lots of them and lots of landmines,
mm-hmm.
lots of situations where if you don't keep up with the timing and you let it slip by, you know, even just one day, then that's a problem. For example, you know, you have a case in Onslow County where our answer was due yesterday and then I ended up being out of town on Friday, a planned trip with mm-hmm. my family. On Thursday, I had a very a limited day because of the snow. I mm-hmm. was there all day, but I had limited staff.
Right.
So I had to get this answer done. So how important is it? Well, we get it done. Well, you don't trust it to FedEx or UPS. You have someone personally take it over
right.
there and have it file stamped by 5 o'clock on that day.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's how important it is. Otherwise, you're taking a risk that all of a sudden opposing counsel gets an entry of default first thing this morning.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have to go through all that hullabaloo and take all that time up, you know, dealing with that
and money
yeah. instead, you know, let's deal with it perfectly. And mm-hmm. life's a whole lot easier.
Yeah,
that's just
that's
the
right.
way it needs to be dealt with perfectly. You have to adhere to those timing requirements.
Yeah, and you, as you've learned, not only I imagine it was impressed in law school, but you've learned now in a couple of decades of practice, is that this is a hard and fast rule for many judges. They're not going to be lenient on that.
It's a hard and fast rule, and you know, in law school, you learn a lot about the timing. You learn a lot about how long you have to do this and statute of limitations, but you don't learn really about how important it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's important in the
yeah.
real world of practicing as an attorney, which I've been doing now for about 18 years. It is just a number one on the top of the list.
Mm-hmm.
You always have to deal with the timing issues in the case first and foremost. In the event you don't, then you may not have a case or you may create
right.
a serious problem for your client in their case, and therefore you've created a problem for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You're negligent. You can't be negligent as an attorney. You have to be, you know, like I say, perfect with regard to these things.
Yeah, and some timing issues, as you talked about before, depending on like you interrogatories and you're giving answers,
right.
any number of things, you may be asking for an extension. But at
That's
some
right.
point in time, that ends, right?
Well, normally when we're talking about discovery, you have 30 days. And then in the event that you ask for an extension of time within that 30-day period of time, you'll have 60 days total.
But you can't ask for it on day 31.
That's right. You can, but there needs to be for good cause. Mm-hmm. It needs to be something, you know, a health issue or something, you know, family loss or something like that happened that was an emergency at the last second. You know, the right way to do it is obviously get your extension within that 30-day period of time and then adhere to that total 60 days. So you don't obviously have problems with the case. So as we were talking about earlier as well, you know, this statute of limitations timing issue and looking at, you know, what's collectible in the event you paid something that maybe has been determined to be something that you didn't have to pay.
Right.
That's an interesting dynamic. And really what we do with that is we look very closely at our different statutes and our rules to determine which one applies for that. And I think we're going to take a break.
We'll come back and take a look at that. If you have questions, you'd like to call in 800-818-2255, 247-7282, 353-4674. Hey, welcome back here on Coastal Daybreak here on the Talk Station FM 107 and AM 1240. Thanks for joining us. And Wes Collins is with us from Harvell and Collins Attorneys at Law. And Let's Talk Legal. We're talking about time and statute of limitations.
Right. So the statute of limitations doesn't always just apply to cases where you're talking about how long do you have to bring your claim. Of course, as mentioned previously today, normally when you're talking about personal injury, it's 3 years or 3 years from a breach of contract. But there are lots of different statute limitations. It also applies in situations where maybe it's been determined that there's been an overpayment. Mm-hmm. I've had cases, you know, where we've had situations dealing with, payment with regard to like tap fees. I think I had one with the town of Newport one time with regard to a mobile home and, you know, determined that the way that they were charging, it was a mobile home park actually, the way that they were charging the tap fees was not consistent with North Carolina law as it related to how many meters there were.
Right.
There was a case out of Durham that indicated you can only charge one if there's one meter, and it happened to be like an apartment building, and there was one meter but multiple users, and Newport was charging for multiple charges just because there were multiple. So it was acknowledged by the attorneys, good attorneys for the town of Newport, no question. It was acknowledged by them that, you know, the analysis of the case was correct. And then we got into this, you know, big discussion about, well, how far back can we go? And, you know, the statutes just weren't really crystal clear with regard to that. You know, I think we settled on a 3 year period of time. It could have been two. And then the default is in North Carolina is that if you don't have a specific statute on point as it relates to whatever that issue may be, then it becomes a 10-year statute of limitations.
Oh, really?
Yep. Yeah. That's the way that works. It's a catch-all statute of limitations. And that is something that is, you know, before us right now in North Carolina. It's an interesting type case that's evolving through our courts, currently in the Supreme Court, as it relates to impact fees, you know, when you build and there's impact on water, sewer, those type things. A lot of times the builders out there, they know they have to pay this impact fee or the developers or whomever it may be. And there's a case out of, Carthage is what it is. Mm-hmm. It's against the town of Carthage in the western part of the state. Where a developer, you know, challenged the impact fee, and that's worked its way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court has made the determination that charging the impact fee was not allowed by statute, and now, and they said basically it was a 10-year statute of limitation. So there we are at another timing issue. 10 years, that's a long way back as far as impact fees go.
Right.
Well, the General Assembly changed that to a 3-year statute of limitations, and they called it a clarification.
Hmm.
Well, that's now been challenged, and it's before the Supreme Court in this case, and the Supreme Court is making a determination as to whether the look-back period here on returning impact fees is 3 years or 10 years.
So you're really talking about clawing back money, right?
You're clawing back money. So, you know, this impact fee situation is evolving. We're involved in it to a certain degree. We may talk about it further on the program at some point in time. But, you know, it's relevant to today's conversation, Ben, because the 3-year, 10-year look back period for this statute of limitations, is what, you know, is currently before the court right now.
Right.
You know, is it going to be only 3 years? And if that's the case, then, you know, the 3 years, when does it run from? I think it would be October of last year, by the way. And that would, so claims that are, you know, some claims across the state would be falling off the back of that as time goes on,
you know.
But then if it becomes a 10-year statute of limitations, then obviously it becomes a much bigger issue.
Now that's a municipal issue that, is going to be, continue to be debated and obviously being litigated.
That's right. And a lot of times you have these situations where the court, you know, may give you direction as it relates to the statute of limitations and how far you can look back, like this particular situation, impact fees. But then you have situations that arise, like the case I was telling you about, you know, just talking about a second ago regarding Newport, that really just doesn't fit. It doesn't fit into any particular statute, you know, and when I talk about statute, we have, you know, the 3-year statute of limitations, and then there's like 15 things on the list.
Yeah.
These are the things that fall under that. And then the 3-year, and then the 6-year, these are the things that fall under that. Well, a lot of times, you know, you end up with these hybrid type situations where it's determined that whatever was charged, you didn't have authority to charge it, but it's not on the list. So does it become 10? Then we've got to research to see if there's cases that have dealt with it. So, timing is just pervasive in everything that we do. I mean, it's kind of obviously I realize that timing is important in life, period. Mm-hmm. But as it relates to the law and it relates to litigation and it relates to claims and these type things and clawing back, it just dictates just about everything. And in many cases, it ends the analysis because you make a determination very early on the situation you're dealing with. Well, we're time barred with regard to that. If a client maybe comes in late on whatever issue it is and we start talking about it and it's just over. For example, the elective share.
Mm-hmm.
That's one that we see very often in as much estate work as we do. The elective share claim, 6 months from the issuance of the letters of testamentary. Sometimes we have surviving spouses come in and maybe they're not happy with what their deceased spouse left them.
Right.
They have the elective share claim, right? But it's a 6-year statute or 6 month statute of limitations.
You got to act on it.
You've got to file it within that period of time. And you have to file it yourself or through power of attorney. If you die, the surviving spouse, your heirs can't file it.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the way that works. So, you know, we have to be very cognizant of all of these moving parts, no matter what type claim it is, as it relates to the timing issue, statute of limitations, litigation time frames. It just is, in every part of every file that we deal with.
Are there some instances where a claim can kind of be put on hold? Is this the term tolling?
Yeah, tolling. Yep. And you mentioned that last week, and it was, you know, basically, you normally have a tolling of a statute of limitations under a couple circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
One of them would be by agreement, okay, but that agreement needs to be in writing.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that you're dealing with another attorney and there's something that we're working through on the case and the other attorney agrees to toll the statute of limitations so you don't have to actually file your lawsuit to preserve your right.
Right.
But that would need to be something, you know, in writing.
In writing,
yeah. No question. That's the first thing. Second thing is that, you know, if we have someone who is incapacitated, but they would have to be adjudicated in that way, mm-hmm. or if they're a minor. For example, let's say that you have a situation where someone is injured at birth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And they have.
Obviously, they can't act on that.
They can't act on it because they're not a majority age yet. And so, what would your guess be about when the statute of limitations would end for that person?
For an injury at birth?
Injury at birth, yeah.
I would guess probably like 28.
Yeah, 19.
19.
Yep, that's dealt with.
I was doing 10 years from 18.
Fair enough, yeah. Yep. That's fair enough. But Yeah, that's dealt with here in North Carolina. Injury at birth. I mean, obviously, the guardian, natural guardian, or parents of the child could bring the claim while they're a minor. But the statute of limitations is going to be told against this person until they reach majority age because they are a minor. So that would be another example, or an actual adjudication of incompetence would stop that as well for someone, let's say, that has a cognitive deficiency or something like that.
All right, more to come in a moment here on Coastal Daybreak on the Talk Station, and Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. Hey, welcome back here to Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law. Our number is 800-818-2255, 247-7282, or 353-4674 if you want to take part in the program here in a couple of minutes that we have left. But talking about statute of limitations, now let's go back kind of to the beginning. If you have a credit card dispute, you have a dispute over payment of services or anything like that, you've had some work done at the house, all of these events, little events of life, if you want to argue those things, they all have their own statutes, right?
That's correct. What I would tell folks with regard to credit card disputes would be that, you know, if you haven't paid on that credit card in more than 3 years and you're concerned about the credit card company coming after you, it's probably best not to make a further payment on that. Now, of course, there's ramifications there, but if you haven't paid in 3 years, your credit's probably tanked anyway.
Yeah, that's true.
But if you had like a circumstance, you know, maybe there was an illness or something like that, you just couldn't pay it. Well, if the credit card company is calling you and saying, oh, if you'll just send us $100, then we'll lay off.
Right.
Well, that may just be a trick to try to get you to revive the statute of limitations because typically in those situations, the statute of limitations is going to run on that if you haven't made a payment in 3 years. So that would be, you know, like you say, that's one of those type situations we look at. And sometimes we deal with credit card cases. You know, we deal with so many estates. People die. They have credit card debt. We deal with that sometimes through the estate. Sometimes there's lawsuits that are brought for collection of the credit card debt. You know, we're looking very closely at the statute of limitations with regard to that. I mean, our job isn't necessarily, let's be frank about it, not to do what's morally right, pay your debts, that kind of thing.
Right.
Our job is to direct our clients through the law and give them the options. And if a client makes a determination that they just can't pay that credit card debt, then obviously it's our job to defend against that claim, you know, as zealously as we can. We're duty bound to do that as attorneys. So one of the first things we look at, obviously, is the statute of limitations on those. And, you know, I've had many, many credit card cases in the past, whether it's estate related or otherwise, where, you know, the credit card company just didn't do what they needed to do by filing their action within the necessary time frame. And there hasn't been a payment in 3 years. And it's just a claim that they can't collect. So again, the details are really what direct all of that, you know.
So that's why you call on the folks at Harvell and Collins Attorneys at Law. Go to harvellandcollins.com, find that 1107 Bridges Street in Moorhead City. And we'll see you next week.